Welcome to A New Lens with Comma Good Capital, where we talk with investors, RIAs, fund managers, and philanthropists about their experience within different impact investing themes, as well as explore the power of stewardship and capital. I'm your host, Jeff Schaefer. It's grateful to be with you all here today. Today, I'm very excited to introduce Santiago Sadaka. And in fact, we just met. I'll give you a little background on how we met. Fortescreen, I think most of you know, my younger brother lives in Rwanda, and we're doing renewable energy assets there. Also, Fortescreen is doing some housing as well. But one of the partners at Fortescreen is a guy by the name of Michael Spraggins, who we've had on the podcast before. He started LifeNet International roughly 12 years ago. And that is how Santiago and I are connected today, because he is the CEO. And he will give you more background there. The other thing that was fascinating I just learned is he's had a career really working in this what he describes as private sector development, and also blended finance, which is based on what you were telling me and what I know, that's been an emerging term. So I'd love to hear how you've seen that kind of transition over the years. And then you've been heavy in the emerging market. So welcome and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Jeff.
So why don't you start off, give us a little bit of your background, where you grew up, a little about your career, so that we understand the lens at which we have this discussion about. And also, I may interject, but tell us a little about what you're doing at LifeNet as well.
Of course. So my background tells a little bit about where I am today. So I'm originally from Argentina. I grew up in various parts of Argentina, but mostly outside of Buenos Aires. And I grew up in an evangelical family where just about every male figure in my family was a pastor or a missionary of some sort. We moved between the United States and Argentina, even Canada, up until the age of 14. And at 14, we settled in Massachusetts, where we had some family, and my father had a job there in an international Christian organization. And that is where I became acquainted with these sets of institutions, these Christian liberal arts colleges like Gordon College, Wheaton College, Biola, Westmont. There's several of these excellent institutions, which I think are a critical part of American Christianity.
Santiago, did you know I went to Wheaton?
I did not know that you went to Wheaton.
I'm a grad of Wheaton, as is my wife. So I didn't pay you to say that, but there you go.
I am a grad at Gordon College. I was in Massachusetts, and having grown up in a Christian family and with the sort of background I described, I still had a sense that what I wanted to do when I grew up was not to be a pastor or a missionary. I wanted to do something else, something that did good in the world, but that there were other avenues in life. I had one mentor, or I had a grandfather who did other things beyond just his church involvement. He actually was a scientist in the Argentine Atomic Commission. And I always saw him as some sort of a role model. Where at Gordon, I saw that and I learned a great deal, and I was formed really in understanding how God doesn't really have a hierarchy of vocations, and that he is calling people to do all kinds of things in the world because there are all kinds of needs that they're going to be met in different ways. And the church, of course, is critical for that. But there are a lot of very other ways in which people can earn a living and dedicate their, you know, most of their hours to that are going to have a great deal of social positive, hopefully, social impact. And I was always interested growing up in Argentina, moving to the United States and so on. I was always interested in international affairs, international finance, international economics. And eventually through a couple of detours, you know, I had an economics, political science majors at Gordon College, and then came to Washington, D.C., where I came to the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University, where a lot of my classmates were basically getting their finishing degrees to go to the Foreign Service. I spent my time dedicated in studying international finance, international investment, and getting acquainted with what was then the literature was talked about as private sector development. Basically, how do you use business for economic growth, and what are the different methodologies? And I'm talking here about export development, investment attraction, public-private partnerships were starting to be talked about, enterprise development in the Christian community and elsewhere at that time, microfinance was significantly discussed. So those were early things that I got involved with. And right after college and then grad school, I joined a consulting firm that essentially gave advice both in the United States and internationally on how do you help economies grow and improve people's livelihoods.
Let me ask you a question on that. In the context of what you just said, so the private sector development, how much of that industry or thought process was influenced by faith? And I don't necessarily mean your own, but I mean just faith in general, and how much of it was just governments and economies looking at it from a pure financial standpoint?
I think more of the latter, unfortunately. I think that we get to the international development space, and I don't mean to sound critical, but I think I believe this. I think that churches in general, not all of them, but churches and missionary societies, whenever they have wanted to do good in the world, they quickly went to charity, setting up a school, setting up a clinic, setting up some sort of a service that was needed in some part of the world. I think policymakers, economists, some of which were Christian, some of which I'm sure were not, who were trying to grow economies and get people out of poverty, I think they have thought, they were thinking from 50s, 60s, 70s, and of course you can go back even further, but for our purposes, about how do you grow economies? And that is where you go from just the policy, the macroeconomic policy world, to the programmatic world, which is how do you actually develop country level, regional level, sometimes city level strategies to actually get your economy to grow further. Hopefully, we've now talked about inclusive growth, so growth that actually touches as many people as possible within your society. So that literature, that discussion was not necessarily happening in Christian circles.
So what do you say to, and just for the sake of this discussion, we'll leave it at Christians, kind of U.S. Christians, just so we can isolate the discussion. I mean, you already said that churches, whatnot, tend to fund, you know, very specific things, but didn't necessarily look at the system or the structure above. What do you say to a Christian today if you are working on that system and structure that feels more governmental of like, well, that's not very faith oriented. What's faith oriented is building a hospital or a orphanage, and the other stuff is, that's not really faith oriented. How do you describe that or challenge people to think differently?
So I think happily, the American Christian environment has evolved in that. I think that churches, you know, places like the colleges you and I went to do talk about social impact in much more varied ways. So I think a critical piece of this came in through the movement around microfinance. So microfinance, particularly in the 80s, although it started earlier, some of the microfinance methodologies, again, you can get pretty wonky about where the beginnings of it were. For all intents and purposes, in the 80s, there's a microfinance movement. Christians really liked that. And organizations like Opportunity International and others really got on the microfinance bandwagon and said, look, this is a good approach of doing good in the world, but using business principles. And I think that kind of opened the minds of a lot of people that you could use, and I know I'm talking about business principles for doing good in other ways as well, right? And I think that opened the door for things like Christians getting involved into impact investment, getting involved into innovative financing, getting involved into microfinance. You also probably got involved in micro enterprise development and helping the poor, once again, through business principles. So I think that that door has been opened. I think that most large Christians, you know, the more sophisticated organizations play in some of that space, perhaps not in some of the more niche and some of the more nuanced or what I would call the most innovative spaces in private sector development. But the principles are, I don't think you now have to have a conversation on why you may want to do that. I think people who are interested in finding out information, they will get information.
Well, I need you to travel with me because I think you're giving, from my experience, maybe Christians a little more leniency than I give them. So maybe I just have the bad heart. So do this for us. To set the context again, FortisGreen and LifeNet have one of the founders is similar on both. And so what's been very exciting is there's been an announcement here recently, which really is a blended finance opportunity, which we're not going to go into all the details, but just know that in FortisGreen, the second fund, one of the benefactors of that fund, not through any of the investors' ownership or anything, but some of the economics will actually go to LifeNet, which is so cool. You do what you do all day long. Plus, it's a great story for Fortis Green because they're about impact. And so not only are they providing power, but then also to divert some of the revenue to help you on the healthcare side is so exciting. So just give us a little framework about how long you've been at LifeNet. And then that may also set a little bit of the stage, but then what LifeNet does so people can get an understanding of that.
First of all, Jeff, we're excited about the investment taking place because we are going to be a beneficiary and we hope to do a lot of good with those resources that come our way. So very happy about the announcement. So a little bit about how I ended up where I am and talk a little bit about what LifeNet is. So most of my career has been in this space of providing advice and implementing programs of what I call private sector development. You know, how do you improve people's livelihoods using different methodologies, as some of the ones that I've described, to make impact at scale. Mostly it has been done through funding from the World Bank, UK Aid, Australian Aid, USAID, and so on and so forth. That's what I've done for 25, 30 years. Now, through that work, and it's been in mostly secular or exclusively secular organizations, through that work, I've come across a number of models of people wanting to do good with various sources of capital, whether it's commercial capital, whether it's government capital, whether it's philanthropic capital. And for some time, I've been wanting to work in an explicitly Christian organization where I could tell people that what I'm doing is because of me being a Christian and not really have to go about it in a roundabout way. I wanted to just let people know that what I'm doing is because I think that this is a great way of sharing Jesus' love. And I found a model in LifeNet, and frankly, I didn't know much about it until the opportunity came to me. I'll explain what LifeNet is. Essentially, it is a network of up to 500 faith-based facilities. These are small clinics throughout sub-Saharan Africa. We're in 7 countries in particular that will have been started, in many cases will have been in operation for a few decades, in very removed places. And oftentimes the quality of care, not because people didn't want to, but because of resources or knowledge, just wasn't, you know, up to very good standards. And we come along and we coach and we train and we certify these facilities to LifeNet standards. And we create a network of these close to 500 facilities that are providing primary care in places where there's not a lot of access. So most of the things that our clinics do are provide care for malaria, for HIV, for TB, for the regular happenings that take place in any household, but also in particular for moms to come in and give birth. And one of the things that we're most proud of is that we know that because of the work that we do, every year 5,000 moms and babies don't die because they are getting care in one of the LifeNet facilities that has been very well trained in resuscitation techniques, dealing with hemorrhage and all the common sources of death that occur for moms and babies. So our work is to come along. We don't own any of these facilities. We don't hire the people that work inside these facilities, but we do have over 100 coaches and trainers throughout Africa that are coming along these facilities and spend about 3 years going multiple times a year in teaching and in coaching on medical practices, but also in management practices. So a key thing that happens is that, and people who have been to some of these places would know, is that you might get told, yes, you need to take this or that or the other in order to deal with a specific ailment. And then there's pharmacy doesn't have anything in stock. And you have to go and travel another 50 miles to the nearest city to be able to get the medicine that you need. So all the pharmacies that are part of our LifeNet facilities are well-stocked. They're well-maintained. They can anticipate the medicines that they're going to need. And you can go from country to country, whether it's Burundi or Kenya or Malawi or Ghana or wherever it is. And you can see that the pharmacies in all of our clinics, they look the same by and large. And so through these various sources or types of coaching and training, we are able to do a lot with really relatively very few resources. So each patient visit, when you kind of add it all up, costs about $6 for the patient between the medicine that they buy, the paying the doctor, and so on. It costs about $6. Our training and coaching costs are constitute about 47 cents. That's the exact number. I'm sure there's some imprecision in there from country to country. But those 47 cents that we spend incredibly improve the quality of the other $5.50 that are being spent. And so through the resources that we bring and the way in which we apply these resources, we significantly improve about 10.5 million patient visits per year throughout 7 countries in Africa. That is a wonderful model of cost effectiveness, of efficiency, that I can really get behind, and I was excited to get behind and say, yes, this is something that I can try to advocate for. And the opportunities are tremendous. In sub-Saharan Africa, about in many countries, between 40 and 70% of healthcare is actually provided by faith-based organizations, clinics that are owned by churches, missionary groups, the Catholic Church, and so on. And so if we can improve the quality of service and management in these facilities, we can significantly improve the quality of healthcare throughout Africa. And the number of, we're working with 500, there's 1,200 that are ready for us to be coming in and work with them. And that's just in the 7 countries that we're in. I think we can multiply our efforts 3 times, 5 times, 10 times. I don't want to say easily. We can definitely do that in a very clear way.
What's the limiting factor in executing on that growth?
2 things I would say. I think it's, you know, like with any good operation, you want to make sure that you have the right trainers and the right coaches, and you have the right capability to be able to provide that effective coaching. More significantly, I would say, is receiving the philanthropic resources that we need in order to be able to fund those coaches and trainers. I know that this podcast is about capital and all types of capital. And I've spent most of my time working on, you know, investable, you know, commercial types of investable opportunities. We are the type of investment that, while we are using business principles for building the model that we have, we're not really at a stage, we're not set up in a way in which we can receive commercial capital. We need philanthropic capital to be able to make the engines run. And so we depend on having more people come along our work and see that, you know, this is a good way of using their charitable contributions.
I have my own opinions on this, which I won't divulge or go into right now, just for the sake of time. But there's a lady that I had on a previous podcast. She was a nonprofit in the nonprofit world for most of her career. And it was all around helping to solve human trafficking. She had to make a decision, or she at least chose to make a decision, to take that same thematic cause and turn it into a for-profit business, fundamentally because she felt to scale and at the speed of which is needed because it's such a massive problem, she had to go to a for-profit model. Literally, her words are, what I realized in a nonprofit world, nobody wants to invest in technology and nobody wants to invest in people. And all of her stuff is technology-based and people-based. And so she's like, to solve this, I have to become a nonprofit. So ironically for her, she still has the same heart and the same mindset. She's just like, I got to put myself in a different wrapper. And so I'd just be curious if you have any thoughts or comments on that. And not that you need to answer this question that bluntly, But I am going to ask the question of, do you see where potentially a life net, and there's, you know, I'm not holding you to this, but do you see where there are ever pieces of it that could be structured in a way that has a reoccurring revenue so that you can scale apart from just 100% philanthropic capital?
So that woman is a kindred spirit of mine. You know, I think that when you can find a commercial solution, go for it. I mean, that's the best way to be able to scale, right? There's a reason why Coca-Cola shows up in every single town throughout Sub-Saharan Africa or Latin America or so many places in Asia, because there is that for-profit motive is a great way to getting people motivated to get a product into a specific place. So the answer is, so there's a couple parts to that question. I have found that nonprofits and for-profits sometimes are a lot more alike than what you would think. So there are good for-profits and there are badly managed for-profits. I've worked in some of them. We've wasted hundreds of millions of dollars of investors' dollars at some points. And on the nonprofit side, I've seen some that have a very good orientation toward effectiveness, toward investing, toward being able to look at the medium and long term, and hopefully you're working with one that is trying to have impact at scale or have impact sustainably or in an enduring way. So you could, and we do at LifeNet, apply those good, important principles, which if they're true, they're true. They should be true for us as well. So to the degree that I can and that we can identify ways to be able to do some of the things that we do in a commercial basis, we will explore that. Given the communities that we're in and the specific place that we're in, it's hard to identify those things. They generally will be subsidized either through government, which is, you know, health is one of those things where government generally finds a good return on investment to put in public resources into, or they will be subsidized by churches and other entities who come in and take the place of government where government's not there. You could make a case that maybe there could be private for-profit health facilities that could come along and, you know, figure out a way in which to make a sustainable impact there. We haven't seen too much of that, to be honest with you, in the places in Africa, in Sub-Saharan Africa that we work. And we want to make sure that the care is empathetic care, that is care that is consistent with the human dignity, that we believe that you know, we're all made in the image of God, and that these people, brothers and sisters, are receiving care that we would want them to receive. And there's the aspect of as well that the church has found over its 2,000-year history that providing health care and taking care of the sick has been a wonderful witness. And I think that there is something to, there's a real reason why churches, you know, one of the first things that they want to do when they try to want have an impact in their community, they want to set up a facility. Christians want to go be doctors and nurses. They want to help people. So if you're not going to be a pastor or a missionary, the next best thing often was, all right, I'm going to be a nurse or a doctor, right? In that hierarchy of vocations that I was trying to speak against. However, but there's a there. I think people do want to be, I think churches find that to be a very good practical way of showing Jesus' love. And I think that is a good way to spend charitable dollars. And so I'm very happy to be able to advocate for people to invest into a LifeNet and to let them know that they're not just investing charitable dollars, they're investing in a way in which it's going to be used as much as possible using business principles. So they will be effectively used. We can talk about the impact. We can talk about models. And we can even talk at this stage, because we have 500 facilities, about systemic impacts that we can have in the entire country. So those are all good things about the LifeNet model and why I'm doing what I'm doing.
So let me dive one more layer into this capital question I ask everybody. When did you realize the power of capital, and what does that mean to you?
Probably I've got several types of realizations. So I'll talk about a project that I helped manage in design in Colombia, where it was a $12 million program. We were helping about 300 small and medium enterprises, providing technical assistance to try to help them deal with some naughty business or strategy issue that they had. And we did very good work in identifying those naughty issues and helping them work through that. And as we were evaluating what was going on, the project, this is a 3-year project, and we were evaluating towards the end of the project, how were companies faring after receiving this technical assistance? What I saw was that all the good ones, the best ones, first thing that they did is they went and knocked on the doors of their banks and said, hey, I need a loan to be able to implement this technical assistance to expand my operational capability, to expand into human resources. And essentially what I saw is that while the consulting job that we would provide might have cost $10,000, say, they would probably spend about $1 million or so, about 8, 10, 12 times the amount of money on the technical solution, on the financial resources needed to be able to scale, to be able to implement, to do all the good things which are important for companies to thrive. And so you can't do that without capital. In the world of international development, and frankly, in the business world in general, you know, successful companies are companies that can provide a good or service in a consistent way at scale and for a product or service that is actually needed by someone that's going to buy it. And you probably can't get there. There's a lot of work that's done at a very micro level, trying to help a specific farmer or a specific micro entrepreneur that is just very segmented, very diffused. You really need to, growth happens when you can scale. And in order to be able to scale, to be able to aggregate production, aggregate access to inputs, aggregate access to markets, that generally requires scale. Now, I think that's the history of economic development in the 19th and 20th and 21st century. In order to do that, you need capital. So various points in which I've seen it, I've been part of it, LifeNet needs capital in order to scale right now. So that's, you know, various ways in which I can talk about that.
Okay. And then as a recipient of that capital, especially in the Christian community, the word that you'll hear is stewardship. So I'd just be, any thoughts on stewardship, what that means to you, how it gets played out?
So when I think about stewardship, is about using the resources that we have in a good way. So if you're in a business or a businessman or a management or a strategist or an entrepreneur, you're trying to steward those resources toward achieving that goal, hopefully in a way that's going to meet your investors' needs, but as well as it's going to have a positive social impact. When I think about a church being a good steward of its resources, is trying to think about how does it meet its mission of propagating the gospel and loving our neighbor? And I think what we're talking about just now is our different ways in which churches and Christians can steward those resources toward, I don't want to say good causes, good models, right? People are tired about talking about causes and they shouldn't just, I love it when people are awakened to needs. But I think that good stewardship requires us to put those resources into models and solutions that are actually going to affect that need and do it at scale, do it in an enduring way, doing it in a way that's going to be empathetic, in a way that's going to be respectful of local dynamics. So being charitable still requires one to be excellent. And I think that that's when I think about stewardship, all those concepts come to mind.
Well, as somebody who is running a nonprofit, to hear you speak about stewardship that way and excellence is reaffirming from my perspective. You know, I briefly mentioned this to you before we started this podcast. So I love the way you answered stewardship, because I'm going to go to the thing that you don't want to go through, which is causes, but I'm going to use that as an example. So go back to earlier, this anti-human trafficking cause. What you're really saying is, and I 100% agree, and a lot should be written on this and talked about, is we can agree on a cause, whatever that cause is, but it's really finding the right model and capital to marry to it so that you can ultimately achieve your goal. And as a general statement, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, there are some amazing nonprofits who have scale, but there are many small nonprofits who aren't scaling and probably never will. If the model made sense, they could probably turn it into a sustainable revenue model, and they probably have a much greater chance of scaling. Said differently, there's a theme out there. The reality is you could probably have a nonprofit type of charity model attacking it. You probably could have a for-profit as well. And honestly, to try to blend those at times may be the best solution. So it's really this, to me, this idea of opening our mind that it's not just business capital. It's not just charitable capital. There are different models that maybe don't even exist today that could be very beneficial to ultimately pushing a cause forward and seeing results. Any thoughts or comments on any of that?
Yeah, I've taught a class on this topic, which is, I think what you're getting at is essentially that there are different kinds of, there's a continuum of needs, and you segment them between different types of sectors, whether they're health or livelihoods or education and so on. And there are continuum types of solutions and methodologies. And I think where development comes in is the art and the science of figuring out which methodology fits which need. And I think that the good organizations are able to figure out what is the most cost-effective, scalable, enduring, Christ-like methodology, approach, program that fits that need that is trying to be met. The not-so-good ones will just try to tug at the heart and get people to spend money on something that, you know, could be addressed in a different way. Now, to be clear, there are some needs out there that are just not investable. They're not commercially investable. And you're talking about, you know, human trafficking, where my family is deeply involved and we support human trafficking, anti-human trafficking organizations. My wife's work has been much of her life working with organizations that work in that space specifically. But we support other organizations as well. And we also invest our resources in things that we think are going to have great social positive impact. So it's very important, and this is where the excellence comes in. It's very important to figure out what are the possibilities, what are the good fit solutions given what you're trying to solve.
Yeah, and this is where, now this is in my world, this concept that wealth advisors across the United States, and this may be a bit controversial to some, I can see as the mindset changes around capital. And what I mean by that is at an individual level, I think advisors are going to have to look at a Jeff Schaefer, for example, and not only help me with investable options, but also be able to help me on the charitable side, mainly because as a family, we may just have some common themes that we go, yeah, we want to invest in these themes and we want to make a difference. And at times, they probably need to go to my right pocket, if that's the right way to say it, go after my investment capital. And on the other times, you go after my left pocket, which is my charitable capital. And then there are probably situations you go, look, the best way to do this may be to be a little bit of both. So I actually am excited to see where this goes from an industry perspective. I also think, too, as wealth advisors, who historically it's just about making money, as this other lens comes into play, specifically on the philanthropic side and making a difference, I think you're going to see the worlds come together, and it actually will change even the investment mindset. So this will be a fun thing to watch as we go forward.
Let me interject here a little bit. I think you're getting into a really interesting conversation, because as I've talked about, you know, certain worlds not talking to each other that they should, I think here you're talking about two worlds which are not talking to each other, which, and I don't know what the incentives are for them to talk to each other well, because, you know, the people that might be able to speak well about investment opportunities, investment opportunities, may not be the ones that really know which are the good philanthropic opportunities, you know, and the entire continuum, right? And the incentive structure, and you know this better than I do, Jeff, the incentives are not really there necessarily for those specific advisors to be all that up on all these things. And so that still puts a great deal of onus on the investors themselves to get smart on that. And I think you're giving me an idea about a side business that I need to develop. It does talk about the continuum of opportunities to be able to have social impact.
Here's my simplistic thought, because I'm watching it happen. And I'll start with the great wealth transfer. I don't know the exact number. You see differing numbers, but it's 70 trillion, 80 trillion. I don't know. I don't even care if it's 50 trillion. It's going to go to generally the spouse, and then it's going to go to the kids. And what we know mathematically from surveys is that women are more inclined to think about, and I'm just going to talk about investing with the head and the heart, which does bring together philanthropic. And I know the next generation, ultimately, what I believe is going to happen is as the investor, or as I shouldn't even say investor, as the human being or capital allocator.
That's the steward.
It's the steward. There you go. It's the steward. There you go. That's perfect. The steward, that's wonderful. It's not even the investor or the donor. It's the steward. As they start to view it this way, chances are what happens is advisors who can, A, probably don't get compensated on purely assets under management, get compensated on a retainer or advice, well, then that nonprofit advice becomes just as important as the investment advice. And that stuff is actually happening in the industry. So I think there's some really interesting things that are going to transpire, and frankly, could happen a whole lot quicker, especially with the use of technology and reporting. So like one of the things that you all do, which is so awesome, is the reporting mechanism at LifeNet. I've seen a bunch of that stuff. So to me, you take an amazing model like that, and when you start to lay that on the investment side, people can really sense and experience that investment capital is having. Now you can really talk to that investor and say, hey, LifeNet, they're doing stuff in Africa, healthcare, that nobody else can do in a for-profit. But oh, by the way, here's this other companies or that is also coming in and stepping into Africa healthcare, but they're doing it in a way that at scale that LifeNet never can. Well, now you've got the whole lineage in that family going, we're in on that theme. I'm making this up. Grandma's is about LifeNet. So-and-so is around the 35-year-olds around the investment. And I'm not so sure those stereotypes are ultimately going to stay true. But then you should start speaking to the family and from a legacy standpoint, from a theme perspective holistically. And then I think it gets really exciting.
I think there's a lot of good, exciting developments ahead. I do think that in the meantime, it would be a great shame to not go as fast as we can in educating and then allocating that capital, whether it's philanthropic or commercial, hopefully impact. I think we need to get there. We need to get there fast. We need to get there well. And if you can have any kind of an impact in getting people there, that would be a great service.
The last question I'm going to ask you, and then we'll close this out, is if you could have a dream come true, what would it be? Naturally, everybody wants to put family. You can put family in there. But if you also had one non-family as well, what would that be?
I'll give you three. One is for my kids to find their calling and to be excited about what it is that they're doing, whether it is similar things to what my wife and I do in the social impact space and the policy space, whether it's in the business space, be a teacher or a soccer coach, whatever it is. The second thing, I think it very much relates to what you're talking about. I think it's for the church to find good footing. So I don't, in no way, shape, or form, I'm no theologian. I am no biblical scholar. I'm not a pastor. But I think that there's a lot that the church can do here in ways in which it can be a tremendous witness in the world. And I think that, you know, we will be known by our love, right? Can we do this well? I think that's a dream of mine, of course. Many are trying and are doing really good things. There's so much more that we can do here, Jeff. And then the third one is for Argentina to win the next World Cup.
That's awesome. Well, I got to tell you that I had the pleasure, I think it was my freshman year summer going into sophomore year because I had already had foot surgery. We got to play, and I'm not going to pronounce it the way that you do, but Buenos Aires, we got to play down there. So that must have been 34. 4 years ago or something like that. We played basketball in the different clubs. We went undefeated. It was quite an event. And in fact, the funny thing was, is that basically we were around that general area. And so what we found is that after a while, we were seeing similar players. And so I think what they were doing is these clubs were like, hey, let's get some players over to this next club. And one of our last games, I think we literally were down every second other than like the last 2 or 3 seconds, and we won. But what an amazing culture. And I'm sure you hear the stereotype all the time. The beef was unbelievable, and the people were just so delightful to have us into their homes while we were, you know, after we were playing and whatnot. But I got to tell you, as somebody who has never been an alcohol guy, it was never fun to play at whatever, 8 o'clock at night. And then they take you in and you eat. Well, they put a big pitcher of wine there. And you're like, no, I just want water. I don't really. And so I remember drinking and being like, oh my gosh, give me some food. But I loved Argentina. Is Argentina, do they have the pink house?
Right. The Casa Rosa. That's right. Pink house. That's where the president does his work.
Well, thank you for joining us today. And we will definitely put a description out there about LifeNet. I'm a huge believer in LifeNet. And it's great to get to know you. And I'm excited to see where you take LifeNet over the years to come. Appreciate it. Look forward to meeting you in person someday. And cheer for Fortis Green, that we can, in the next fund, raise a bunch of capital, be highly successful. And then as a byproduct, we will help you save more lives. And actually, that's an amazing model that I'd love to see replicated over and over and over again, as I'm assuming would you. So thanks for joining. And just don't forget to subscribe to New Lens with Common Good Capital. You can find it at your podcast app of choice. Until next time, we'll see you later. Santiago, anything you want to say in closing?
No, thank you, Jeff. This is a great platform to be able to talk about things that are dear to my heart and help me get out of bed in the morning.
This podcast is a production of Common Good Capital and does not constitute an offer or a solicitation of an offer. Such offer would only be made through a private placement memorandum. Prospective investors in private placement securities should be aware that making an investment is speculative and involves a high degree of risk, including the risk of losing all or a portion of an investment. Investments of this nature are illiquid and subject to substantial restrictions upon transferability.